Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Welcome, Amy, co-host. How are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
Oh, I'm good for an old fella.
That's good.
Pretty good. But
had a relaxing weekend.
Yes, me too. Lovely. No grandchildren to look after. It was good. Or great-grandchildren. A couple of weeks ago was the great-granddaughter. Anyway, let's welcome our guest, Dr. Dwayne Haymacher, joining us today. He is an astrophysicist and leader of the Indigenous Astronomy Project at University of New South Wales. Dwayne, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, very well, very well. And, well, Amy?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I thought we'd open by asking you, one, how did you get into astronomy and astrophysics? And then two, how did you get into Aboriginal astronomy?
Oh, that's a good question, actually. You can probably tell from the accent that I'm not local. I'm actually from the U.S. I grew up in the Midwest in a state called Missouri, right in the middle of the country. And as a kid, I was always fascinated with the sky. I grew up, you know, there were more cows in town than there were people, and we had reasonably dark skies. I just grew up with this fascination for astronomy. I did a lot of that stuff in the States, but when I was younger, I came to Australia for a semester and just had the best time of my life. I'd always wanted to come here, and it was fantastic. So I moved to Australia to do astrophysics for a PhD, but I don't know, I kept getting drawn to the cultural side of things and really fell in love with Australia. And after a while, I decided that instead of doing astrophysics, I wanted to do Aboriginal astronomy. It just seemed like something that not many people had done before, and it was just a tremendous wealth of information there.
And, I mean, it hasn't been a huge area of study in the past. I mean, you would have been one of the first who actually looked into it, wouldn't you have?
You know, it's kind of funny I thought that. I mean, yes, you're right for the most part. When I submitted my PhD thesis, I thought, well, yeah, I'm about to be the first person to have done a PhD looking at Aboriginal astronomy. Well, I hadn't done my homework very well. Turns out there was a guy at the University of Leipzig in Germany in 1911 who did a PhD on Aboriginal astronomy.
That's amazing. Did he get a lot of things right looking back at his work? Was it on the right track at the time, or was it just confined by a lot of the understanding of Aboriginal people at the time?
Well, it was written in German. I don't speak German. But no, I translated some of what he wrote, and he seemed to really be on the right track. I mean, you know, for that time and era, he was quite, I suppose you would consider him progressive. But yeah, he collected quite a bit of stuff that, you know, we've been learning about for quite some time. So yeah, he definitely was on the right track.
Our guest, Dr. Dwayne Haymacher, a Missouri man. Missouri? You did say Missouri, did he not, Amy? Yes?
I think so.
Good, yes, yes, well, wouldn't it? That's right, Dwayne, right. A man from Missouri, and he's an astrophysicist, and he's talking to us about Aboriginal astronomy, which is, well, it must have been a problem. Like Amy's already asked you, was there much around? You've said that there was a bloke in 1911, a German, that wrote it all up in his own language, of course. But it still means you were, it was fairly limited. How did you overcome that?
Well, the truth is, there's actually quite a bit of stuff out there. It's just really scattered. So there were, you know, there were early missionaries who wrote a lot of stuff down. There were, I guess what you would consider anthropologists at the time who wrote stuff down, both amateur and professional. And you'd even get, you know, Farmer Bob would write stuff down and they would publish it in the local paper. So there was actually quite a bit of stuff out there. The main problem that you had to address is, first off, finding all the bits and pieces and bringing it together. But you also had to look at the fact that this stuff was written by white fellows, by and large. And with that comes all the biases and mistranslations and all of that, you know, that you can imagine. So you're having to sort through that and try to get the context of what the Aboriginal people were talking about. And, of course, sometimes these people didn't know astronomy very well, and they were actually quite clearly, if you're trained in astronomy, you can tell they were getting some things wrong. So it's a matter of going through and sorting throughout all of that stuff. And then, of course, nowadays, we simply go out and whenever we can, and we speak to the elders to try to fill in the gaps or get the correct context and things like that. So it's a really holistic project.
And Western science is often, I mean, when you look at defining science, it's often seen in a Western context. I mean, how do we define Aboriginal science, would you say?
Well, see, that's a really interesting point. And I guess one of the main things that myself and my colleagues have tried to push forward is the idea that science is not restricted to Western culture or Western civilization, if you will, that science is found in Indigenous knowledge systems. So science you can think of in a broader context as explanations for the creation and evolution of the natural world, trying to understand how things work in our universe, whether it's on a local scale, just, you know, looking at plants, animals, weather, or the stars, or climate, you know, you start expanding to larger areas. It's about understanding the natural world and having explanations for that. And you do that through observation, through experimentation, and it has some sort of predictive purpose. And, of course, Indigenous knowledge systems are full of that. So there's no question that Indigenous knowledge systems have science. They absolutely do.
And how receptive has the Australian scientific community been to that fact? I mean, are you seeing the times change where we're no longer seeing science as such a Western concept?
I think we're getting there, yes. You know, it's been a bit hard because some of the people who would openly talk to me about it were people that I knew personally. And I found that from both ends of the academic spectrum for a while, and even now to a degree, I still get a bit of gruff, if you like, from people who say that, you know, well, there's spirituality and religion in this stuff, so it can't be considered science. And I say, well, you're really throwing the baby out with the bathwater if you do that. So what if there's some spirituality there? It doesn't matter. There's still a tremendous wealth of scientific information that is a real benefit today, not something that would have been beneficial a couple of hundred years ago, but doesn't matter today. No, it does matter today, and it is beneficial. And on the other end of the spectrum, we get some colleagues who think that anything comparing it to Western culture is somehow degrading Indigenous culture. And it's not really that we're comparing with Western culture or Western science. It's just showing that Indigenous knowledge is not beneath Western science or Western culture, that it's every bit as good as and probably better in many respects. So we're navigating our way through this boundary, this terrain here, and I think we're making a lot of headway because we're constantly getting invited to work with astronomers and geologists and biologists. I mean, people doing the ecological stuff for a long time have gotten that recognition, but it's been more the physical science side of things, like astronomy and physics, and we are making headway with those groups.
When you look at the Western scientific tradition, a lot of the discoveries seem to happen from people just wanting to know how the universe worked, and there often didn't seem to be a lot of practical applications. But I guess in Aboriginal society, there was quite a great deal of practicality when you were looking at their knowledge systems. I mean, when you're looking at how they used it to chart the breeding cycles of animals and everything like that, and the tides and the weather.
Absolutely, without question.
Yeah, that practicality, I mean, what other sort of applications did it have to Aboriginal society, learn these Indigenous knowledge systems and being able to use the stars?
Oh, if you can think of it, I'm pretty sure we can find an example, almost everything. And that's one of the great things about looking at, you know, Indigenous astronomy, whether it's Aboriginal or Island or any other culture in the world, you find these close connections between the stars and how they were used for navigation. So whether it was more of a seafaring culture where you know, like the Polynesians and the Melanesians, where you go long distances by following the stars, or in Aboriginal cultures where you had the development of star maps that followed dreaming tracks and song lines, you had all sorts of calendar development, you know, whether it was using the phases of the moon or the positions of the sun on the horizon, like at solstices and equinoxes. You had time management there, but you also had a lot of seasonal calendars that would tell you about, you know, local weather changes, long-term seasonal change, animal breeding cycles, when plants were available. I mean, you can just go on and on. The thing is, all of that practical information was intimately tied in with social structure and ceremony and law and kinship. So you couldn't really, I mean, you could separate the elements of it, but they were all ingrained together. They were all, like I said before, they were genuinely holistic.
How was your accessing our own mob for confirmation, for just to sound them out, to get to document the stories? And there must have been some of their stories or some of their experiences that were similar, explanations of like breeding cycles and things like that, or accessing different bush tucker when the stars were in a particular position. Were you able to access people?
Yes, it's one of those things where, you know, I'm an American and I didn't grow up here, so I knew that the process of how you go about doing this was very different to any experiences I may have had, you know, in the U.S. So I learned as much as I could, and I tried to understand how things are done here. And I knew that there's a proper protocol for doing this, and it takes a long time, and that's fine. You have to build up a trust and a relationship. And instead of us going to people's doors, essentially, and just knocking and demanding information, what has been done for so many years and many times has had such a negative impact. You know, for decades, anthropologists have been going to communities, you know, demand information, take it, and then disappear with no consultation with the community. And then decisions were made without consultation with the communities, or it would get published almost as if the knowledge was owned by the anthropologists. So that's something that we wanted to make sure we did not do. So what we would do is go through the archival stuff, start talking about what we were learning, then explaining that we needed to learn more. And at that point, we were getting contacted by elders saying, look, we'd like to share this information with you. So that was one way that, you know, really helped. Instead of, you know, knocking people's doors down, we were just creating an environment where we were invited to come back. And the second part of that, the similarities, yes, you find remarkable similarities all across Australia and all across the world. And the way that certain stars were understood, patterns in the sky were perceived, even transient phenomena like meteors or comets or eclipses, and many times were seen in very similar ways. And the interesting thing about all of this is you could, when you go to explore it, you can see all of the science encoded within those traditions.
When you look at, you consider, when you listen to a story, because I think, I guess a lot of the early explorers or anthropologists, they might have listened to a story and didn't even realize it was an example of Indigenous astronomy. How do you conclude that those stories are also an example of sort of the astronomical knowledge that Blackfellas had?
Yeah, that definitely is a situation. And I think that's where my background in astronomy and physics really comes in handy. Because when, you know, when I'm sitting down with an elder, so I was in the Torres Strait for a few weeks learning about islander astronomy. And in the Torres Strait, you know, their entire culture was centered around astronomy. And because of my background in physics and astronomy, I can recognize certain things the elders are talking about that I'm quite sure many anthropologists and archaeologists probably wouldn't recognize simply because they're not trained in that area. So one of the exciting things was, you know, sitting with elders and learning from them about how to read the stars and what the different properties of the stars tell you. I can't imagine what perhaps an anthropologist not trained in astronomy would make of it. I mean, maybe they'd figure it out, maybe they wouldn't. But I could recognize right away the astronomy, the physics and astronomy behind what they were describing. And it was really great.
Dwayne, we're talking about the world's first scientists, are we not?
Yeah, really we are.
Yeah. Now, when you say that these people haven't been trained to see the signs or to understand the way that you do, understand the First Nations astrology and stories on astrology or experiences with astrology and knowledge in astrology.
Astronomy.
There is a difference, is there?
Yeah, okay, especially right. To a scientist.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks for that.
I was just thinking you're probably just
saving
horrified.
Oh, thank you, Amy, saving me there. But my point here is, Dwayne, too many of these white experts have spent far too much time making us invisible, diminishing our knowledges and our knowledge base, our experiences, writing us out of history. Far too many of us, and I think it's still a thing in their minds today where they must continue with it. I mean, do you understand where I'm coming from here?
I absolutely do. I mean, it's one of these things where I've only been working in this area for the last 7 or 8 years, you know, fairly recently, we think about it. And I've heard all of these stories and anecdotes and, you know, I've read academic papers about what has happened in the past with anthropologists and archaeologists. But I will stand up to their defense now because I know they've made huge steps into correcting a lot of what used to happen. A lot of the stuff that used to happen doesn't happen as much anymore. But we'll definitely try to give the anthropologists and archaeologists some credit in that respect. I don't want to, you know, trample all over them. I know they are making headway to improve that. And the universities are very privy to this, too. There's very strict ethics protocols and guidelines we have to go through to do research and work with communities. So I know we are definitely moving forward in that respect. But, of course, there is a long history of that. And, of course, from time to time, you still find people falling into that. And you know, we really have to get this information out to the public. And in the last few years, I've seen the public's perception of this really change. And, of course, you really got to promote this stuff to, I hate to say it, but our politicians, because they're the ones who really got to convince this stuff is real. You know, it's not just some leftist ideals or something like that, which many will try to make it out to be, but it's something very real. And if we can learn to appreciate, understand that, and learn from that, I think we can really move forward. Otherwise, we're just going to keep going in circles or moving backward.
How much do you think the fact you're American contributed to you having a much more open-minded approach to Aboriginal astronomy? Because I noticed the other sort of leader in the field is actually British, Ray Norris. I think he's at University of Macquarie University or another university. Do you think the fact you're an outsider to Australian made you more able to see the complexity of Aboriginal knowledge systems?
And more appreciative of it, the knowledge?
Yeah, you know, I think maybe so. Ray Norris is British, and he was my thesis advisor when I was at Macquarie. He's actually at the CSIRO. I retired recently, but he's now got a position at Western Sydney as well. So he's still doing some work too. But yeah, it was curious because we had talked about how our research group, when it started, and the research group I have at UNSW now, was majority foreigners. I mean, Ray's British. I'm American. Another one of my PhD students is British. Another one's American. Another one coming in is from Portugal. You know, so we've got, oddly enough, this group of mostly non-Australians. I mean, we got some Australian students coming in, and, of course, some Indigenous students coming in as well. But I think it's one of these situations where, as a foreigner, if you will, I was always fascinated with Australia and wanted to actively learn about it. And if you look at many of the universities across the country, if you go to the first year Aboriginal studies or Indigenous studies units, particularly the general education ones, you'll find them dominated by international students and predominantly Americans. I give guest lectures at UNSW, and I think something like two-thirds of it, of the class or international, most of them are Americans. And I could speculate on why that's the case, but when people come to this country, we want to learn about stuff. Whereas if you're local, you may not be as interested, or worse off, you may be part of the cohort who's been indoctrinated into sort of a racist attitude where Aboriginal people were somehow, you know, below white society and they weren't smart enough, they weren't good enough. And if you have that mentality, then you're not going to be interested in learning about it.
Yeah, that's very true, and I hope it changes very soon. The other thing I was interested in, the fact, did Aboriginal people, I mean, when you look at mathematics, again, it's seen as that westernized sort of concept, but was there evidence that blackfellas had a complicated system of numbers or using numbers or a form of mathematics that might not be the same as Europeans?
Absolutely, yes. There's a huge area called, well, when people study science and culture, they tend to stick the word ethno in front of it. So ethno-astronomy, ethno-mathematics, ethno-science. And that's really meant to kind of appease everybody by saying, well, it's science, but it's not the same as Western science. And whether that's good or bad, I mean, you can argue the semantics there. But there is a huge field called ethno-mathematics, which looks at the number systems and the mathematical systems of Aboriginal cultures. And yes, there were incredible mathematical systems. They weren't done in the same way as Western mathematics, and that's fine. I mean, so what? They were still complex systems. And I know that I haven't done a whole lot of work in this field myself, and it's something we'd love to get a student on. In fact, one of the academic staff at Nuragili, or the Indigenous Center at UNSW, who works with Indigenous students on numeracy, actually has a PhD in ethnomathematics. So it's something that we're hoping to get some students in the future to begin working on. But, I mean, I know there's been research done, and I think that some of the kinship systems in Walfrey, for example, were based on group theory. I mean, there's all kinds of mathematical systems that were developed around kinship and stuff like that. So it's that is a really underrepresented field now. I mean, Aboriginal astronomy is miles ahead of Aboriginal mathematics at the moment, but we're hoping to really, you know, start working in that field soon.
Yeah, because I'm really interested, and tell me if this is a stupid idea, but when you look at the breakthroughs in physics and you think of it only ever came from a couple of people like Isaac Newton and Albert Einstein, and I think of Blackfellas being here for 60, 70,000 years, and I just wonder if we'd already come up with those breakthroughs or we'd had that, because it was almost an uninterrupted occupation. And when you look at science and you look at how it was interrupted by people who are just closed-minded and religion and everything like that, I just wonder if we had figured it out a long time before Westerners had figured it out, and it's just been, in a way, demolished, or we don't understand it.
Especially when those Westerners have come out of the trees, out of the caves, some 15 to 20,000 years after, behind us sort of thing.
Is that?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, is that possible, that we could have come up with it way before Einstein ever did? A theory of relativity, or even a theory to connect everything.
What we got to remember as well is, you know, in Western science, the history of Western science, it was never one person who discovered everything. It's always standing on the shoulders of giants, is one famous quote. Mm. And it was a gradual process. And, you know, we attribute the development of calculus to Isaac Newton. Yeah. That's one of the things he's famous for. Well, actually, somebody else kind of figured it out just before him. Mm. And you have a lot of accounts of, I don't know, plagiarism and stolen ideas. I'm not here to bash on Isaac Newton. I mean, he was a genius. But you had geniuses in all cultures of the world. Mm. But because these, you know, the Western cultures were written cultures, you stick it in the books and you know, send it long distances, it was treated differently from oral tradition. And I think that's a real disservice, because oral cultures, when you sit and try to imagine the amount of stuff that humans memorized, and, you know, before a few thousand years ago, which is just a blip on you know, the human time scale, we didn't have any written languages, structured written languages. You know, you had glyphs and stuff, but that was fine. I mean, there's always this argument that, these oral cultures, they didn't have written language. Look how primitive they are. They didn't have the wheel. Look how primitive they are. Well, neither did you until a couple thousand years ago, and it actually wasn't even Europeans that came up with the wheel either. So let's get over that fact.
The main reason we didn't have wheels was because there wasn't a need for them. If there was a need for a bloody wheel, our mob would have designed it. Don't worry.
Exactly right. Yeah, I mean, there's these silly ideas that people still keep, you know, trotting out when they want to. Yeah, it gets really ridiculous. But the main question you were asking is it possible that Aboriginal people figured this stuff out long ago? And the answer is yes, of course. I don't know about special relativity and stuff like that, but when you look at eclipses, for example, I mean, Galileo's famous for saying that eclipses had nothing to do with the moon. And, of course, we know that tides of the ocean. He said that they had nothing to do with the moon. And, of course, we know that they do, and Indigenous people around the world figured this out a long, long time ago. How long ago, I don't know. But you would have had to figure this stuff out, you know, tens of thousands of years ago. Recognizing that, you know, the tides link in with the phases of the moon, and when the moon is full, the tides are higher. When only half of it's lit up, the tides are lower. I mean, this is the observation that, you know, in an experience people would have had, and they develop this stuff and pass it down through generations. And when we think about the amount of stuff you had to learn, so what I've understood is that when, you know, Aboriginal youth reached a certain age, usually in their early to mid-teens, they would go through an initiation. It's called different things around the country. I think in Gamilaroi country, it was a Bora ceremony. When you actually sat down and tried to figure out how much stuff they had to memorize, the students, if you want to call them students, the youth, would have to memorize dozens, hundreds of stories that could take hours to recite. And that's just one tiny little bit of what they had to memorize. Human memory is amazing. And we don't think of it nowadays because you pick up your phone and you have the whole of human knowledge at your fingertips. You don't need to memorize anything anymore. But, you know, when you put that in song and dance and story, you reinforce that knowledge over and over and over, and you can memorize humongous amounts of information. That's how it was passed down for tens of thousands of years.
It's a good example you use, you know. We're using mobile phones today. If my mobile phone died and I would not be able to call my closest relatives, my daughters, my friends. I wouldn't be able to call anybody because I don't remember a damn number.
Yeah.
It's all in the phone, and the phone's died. It's dead.
I know one number. It's my former boss, so I don't know how much help that would be. But
Dwayne, is there any of our own, have any black fellas involved or developing their knowledge or studies in this area?
Yes. I mean, it's like I said, it's a fairly, I don't know if it's a new area. The area has been around for a long time, but it hasn't been heavily researched. And I think our group at UNSW is the first one sort of full-time dedicated to this. We are bringing in Aboriginal students. There's a lecturer at UWS named John South who's working with Ray Norris. We've got some Aboriginal students who are coming into our group. It is, you know, there are, like I said, a diverse range of people in our group. They tend to be, you know, not Indigenous foreigners for the most part. But that is something where we're actively recruiting Indigenous students and bringing people in. And, you know, a lot of the stuff we're doing is guided by and mentored by the Indigenous academics at Narragili, in particular Professor Martin Nakata, who's mentoring me on this huge project we have in the Torres Strait.
Okay. And what about accessing First Nations people as far as your knowledge bases go? Do you have particular regions of the country where there are people that you have better access to or that have a better understanding? I mean, how do you cross-check? How do you engage with First Nations people? How do you determine who it is that you talk to?
That depends on a number of factors. And what we've done here at UNSW, because we're in Sydney, we've tended to focus more locally. So we work with Darug and Darawal elders, Gundungurra. Got a student who's just come with us recently who did his master's degree working with Gamilaroi and Uwalji up north with Gilad Michael Anderson and Ray Norris. My first PhD student is working with Wiradjuri community. And the people in the Wiradjuri community invited me to come give a talk 5 years ago. And I've just been slowly building up relations with them since then. So we've tended to focus a little bit closer to home, so to speak. But this project in the Torres Strait, because Professor Nakata is an islander, and I was really fascinated learning about islander stuff, we decided to put in for a major research grant, and we're awarded that. So it depends on geography and funding and contacts, and it's just how the group and the discipline start to build up. And we've got, you know, contacts from around the country, the territory, from the WA, you know, Western Victoria. But because we're in Sydney, we tend to start focusing locally and branching out from there.
Does it sadden you when you think of the impact of colonization and the impact that could have on ever unlocking all of the sort of knowledge in Aboriginal astronomy when you think of just how much was lost, particularly with languages and everything like that?
I mean, yes, it is very disappointing. And I have no delusions of grandeur. I know that we're never going to find everything. And I know that with a lot of the work we're doing, we're trying to reconstruct traditional knowledge, and that's very difficult. And we're not always going to get everything right, but I think if we're rigorous about it and if we work closely with the community, we can try to piece back as much of that together as we reasonably can. And it's up to the community what happens with that in the future. But we're doing our part to just try to help piece together these fragments. In some areas, it's still very, very strong. In the Torres Strait, for example, islanders use stuff every day. This isn't just something restricted to a couple of the elders. The kids are singing songs about the twinkling stars and how that tells them the wet season's coming. They're singing songs about the moon and the sun, and this knowledge is used all the time. Other places, there's been incredibly heavy damage, and you know, most of the traditions have been lost. So it really varies across the country. We're doing what we can to work very closely with the communities and be very rigorous in the stuff that we're doing. And I think over time we can really help some communities out with this. But I know we're never going to get everything exactly as it was. The damage has been done. We're trying to undo some of it as much as we can.
And it's not just about helping communities, is it? Because I was reading recently a story about scientists actually found out about the history of a meteor hitting, I think, an area in, it might have been the Northern Territory or South Australia, but they actually found out about it because it came from Aboriginal stories. So Aboriginal knowledge can actually inform current day science, can't it, and what happened in the past.
Yeah, that would have been me.
It was probably your story, yeah.
So, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that story,
sure.
Then? Yeah,
absolutely. So, I mean, we know that natural events happen, whether it's an eclipse or a comet or a meteorite impact or even a volcanic eruption and tsunami. All these natural events happen. And there are Aboriginal explanations for how these happen and records of particular events, not just a generic event, but of particular events. And there are a number of meteorite impacts all across the country. Meteorite falls, impact craters, big fireballs that go across the sky. Many of them have happened in Australia, and we have records of them from the scientific record. You know, there are impact craters and meteorites that have been recovered. So one of the questions that we're asking is, well, we know Aboriginal people would have seen this stuff, so are there any records of this in oral tradition? About the ones we know about, and are there any records in old traditions about things that could lead us to previously unknown craters or meteorites? And I'd say previously unknown to, you know, white fellows. Obviously, the black fellows knew about it. So initially, a study we did years ago, we couldn't find anything definitive. But then I started doing more research, and then we found several examples where that was the case. So I think the one that you're alluding to is from the Northern Territory. It's a place called Henbury. And it's about 120, 130 kilometers south of Alice Springs. And what happened is about 4,500 years ago or so, a small asteroid came into the Earth's atmosphere. It broke apart because of the pressure, and a bunch of fragments hit the ground, created about a dozen meteorite craters, ranging from 10 meters across to almost 200 meters across. So back in the late 1800s, you had all these, you know, whatever you'd like to call them, white fellows making their way out into the bush and claiming land. And there was this one area where the owners had found these big holes in the ground. They didn't know what they were from. And they, you know, said, well, they almost certainly were not made by humans. It's something natural. And they sat there for a long time, and the white fellows, the farmers, didn't know what they were. They eventually took some geologists up there on an expedition in the 1930s. And they had these reports that there might be what they thought might be caused from a falling star, a meteorite. They took some of the local Aboriginal elders with them. And when they got to the site or near the site, the elders stopped and said, they said in language, you know, we don't go over there. That's a sacred area. Mm. And when they were asked why, they were told, well, that's where the fire devil came down from the sun and hit the ground, set the ground on fire and killed everybody and created those big holes. Is because somebody had broken sacred law.
Wow.
And this wasn't just one time this happened. This is two or three times over the course of a couple of years where different, you know, senior men from around that area were telling them this. And one said that one of the craters does fill up with water after rain events. And said, well, we don't go in there and we don't collect water because if we do, the fire devil will fill it with iron again. So, you know, we looked at the language and it was a Lurcha language. And found out that, yeah, these accounts from this event happened 4,500 years ago were still known in the 1930s. That's how long these traditions have lasted. And there are examples of traditions lasting two, three times that, you know, over 10,000 years, you know, from some of these volcanic eruptions up in Queensland. So we know these old traditions last a long time. And the old traditions have actually led to places like in Victoria where meteorites were found using the description of the oral tradition.
Wow, that's amazing. And in Victoria, I think it was probably another story I read of yours, but there was a tsunami apparently and you were able to track down the evidence that the tsunami happened a very long time ago just from oral tradition, wasn't there, and that it was tied to a volcanic eruption?
We think it is. So this is, we saw some records. First off, we know that the coast down there along Victoria has been hit by tsunamis in the past. We know that. There's records of that.
Because you don't think of tsunamis in Victoria, do you?
I know, you don't, but there have been. And if you look at the geology of Australia, Victoria is some of the youngest geological regions, especially Western Victoria. You had volcanoes erupting a few thousand years ago.
Wow.
I mean, not millions of years ago, just a few thousand years ago. I think Mount Gambier was formed 4,500 years ago. So we had this story that was recorded in the 1840s, or early 1800s, that talked about this great wave that came inland, and it went rushed really far inland and killed everybody except for those who were on the mountaintops. And the tradition actually named the different places. So Professor James Goff, who's a tsunami expert here at UNSW, and I had gone out to Western Victoria just to do a little preliminary search. And we found that there was this layer of ocean sediment about a meter, meter and a half under the topsoil. Now, that's nothing conclusive, but it certainly is suggestive. So we're going to go out and do a larger survey of that region, you know, in the not-too-distant future. So it was really exciting to be able to go out and see an example of, again, where the oral traditions are leading us to new scientific discoveries, something the Aboriginal people have long known, but us white fellows are just catching up with.
That's pretty amazing. Can you tell us a little bit? I was reading a little bit as well. Black fellows didn't only use astronomy and look at constellations, but they also looked at dark spaces in between the stars, for example, the emu in the sky. Can you tell us a little bit about how blackfellas used astronomy and some of the stories to do with that?
Sure, no problem. So when we white fellas, you know, tend to think of constellations, we think of the bright stars where you do a connect the dots pattern and you have a familiar shape. Sometimes you can see those quite easily, sometimes you can't. You know, everybody knows Orion, everybody knows the Southern Cross. In Aboriginal cultures, you had some connected dots constellations, but they were actually pretty rare. So yeah. Some examples would be that the Southern Cross represented a stingray that was chased by two sharks, where the sharks were the pointer stars. And you find that in South Australia, you find that in Victoria, you find that up in northern Queensland. So it's not just like one specific area, you find that across the country. But connected dots constellations were pretty rare. Usually it was in a particular star that represented something significant, or maybe a little cluster of stars. So, for example, the star cluster of the Pleiades, commonly called the Seven Sisters, when that rose early in the morning, just before sunrise, that signaled the start of winter. It signaled a peak in the dingo breeding season in the central desert. Down here on the Sydney coast, it signaled the blooming of the wattle, which is one of the only flowers that blooms in winter, and it signaled the northerly migration of the orca. So you had seasons, plants, and animals all tied in with the appearance of this star in the early morning. And you find lots of examples all across Australia of that. But one thing that you don't think of when you think of astronomy is, like you said, the dark spaces. I don't know if you guys realize how fantastic the night sky is down here in Australia, in the southern hemisphere compared to the northern hemisphere. Because your southern skies point right to the center of the Milky Way galaxy.
Oh, wow.
You see the whole of the Milky Way. You see the Magellanic Cloud. I mean, there's so much stuff to see in the sky down here. And because Australia is relatively dry, well, it is very dry, the skies are much clearer. So when I came to Australia for the first time and got out of Sydney, I was just blown away by what I saw. But in the Milky Way, you can see these fantastic dark shapes, these really prominent dark spaces in the Milky Way. Those represent all kinds of different things. There are crocodiles, there are kangaroos, there are snakes, there are caves, it's a waterway with fish in them. And of course, as you mentioned, the famous emu in the sky, which stretches from the Southern Cross all the way down the Milky Way to Sagittarius and Scorpius. And it looks like the profile of an emu. It's unmistakable. And that signified a couple of different things. When you saw that emu rising above the horizon at sunset, the sun goes down, stars come out, you see this emu rising. That signified the start of the emu breeding season. And you'd see that's when you would go out and collect the emu eggs. Now, in some parts of Australia, you know, where the position of the emu was in the sky at at dusk represented different things. But that's one of the basic ones. The emu was coming out, the eggs were being laid, and later on in the year, at sunset, when the emu was straight up and down in the sky, that's when some of the Boris ceremonies were held. And from what we understand, what we've been told, the reason is because the male emus actually incubated the eggs and helped rear the young. So it was symbolic of the men bringing the boys into manhood, which is why there was that connection.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is you find this across the Southern Hemisphere. So here in South America, the indigenous people of northern Bolivia saw the same shape as a rhea, which is a large flightless bird just like an ostrich or an emu. The Inca saw it as a llama in the sky. So indigenous people around the Southern Hemisphere have very similar traditions when it comes to some of these dark constellations like the emu.
It's pretty amazing, and to me, even wider than Aboriginal affairs, it shows that human beings just have such an innate connection to the universe, doesn't it? The fact that across the Southern Hemisphere, we look up the sky and we see similar things or it equates to similar things. It just shows that deep intrinsic connection all humans have to the universe and what we're part of, do you think?
Oh, absolutely, without question. I mean, there's a reason they consider astronomy to be one of the oldest sciences. I mean, when you talk to the public, you know, and you want to know what their fascination with science is, I'm sure 8 out of 10 times it's going to be something related to astronomy.
Yeah.
The stars are just an amazing thing. We don't think of it so much anymore because most of us live in cities and you can't see the stars anymore. Mm. You can only see a handful of the brightest ones. I think back in the early 90s, there was a blackout in Los Angeles and the power went out across the city. And the 911, you know, your 000, the emergency call service there, was inundated with phone calls from people shocked about this big white thing that was stretched all the way across the sky. They didn't know what it was, and they were freaking out. It was the Milky Way. But they were in Los Angeles.
Wow.
They had never seen this before. They had no idea what it was. I mean, can you imagine that? That seems so ridiculous. But if the lights went out in Sydney or Melbourne or Brisbane or any of these major cities, you can't see the Milky Way from here. If those lights went out, it would come out, and I imagine people would probably be kind of freaked out, wondering what it is. What's this giant white thing across the sky?
Dwayne, for a long time, our people have been locked out of information, I suppose. So my question is, how do our mob access these sorts of studies and documentation? Is it not locked away from our mob? Does it not have its IP locked up with these universities that you guys work for? What's the situation?
No, there's a huge movement with universities now. When it comes to us doing work with Aboriginal and Islander communities, the communities retain the IP, not us.
All right.
Now, the work that we're doing, for example, at Narragili, at UNSW, number one, whenever we have a paper that we publish, we always put it out there for the public. We promote it. We put it on social media. We choose, for the most part, journals where we can have, where the public can get free access to it. So we try to go for free access journals because nothing's more frustrating than wanting to read about a study, especially if it's, you know, somebody wanting to read about their own culture and they hit a paywall and have to pay $30 to read the article. I mean, that's
right. Yes.
So we deliberately target journals. I'm an associate editor for a journal where it's completely free. You know, not just a preprint, but the actual published version. Journal of Astronomical History and Heritage, completely open access, completely free. Everybody can see it. We're also developing a new humongous website, which is going to be a one-stop shop for everything. It's going to have links to papers, to education projects, videos, anything. We're going to just build up as much as we can. So when you go there, you'll have access to all this stuff. Because there's no point in us doing all this research if, number one, we're not going to publish it. So we definitely publish it. And there's no point in doing it as well if we're just going to publish it in these academic journals where you have to hit a paywall. I mean, what's the point of doing that?
Yeah. And just one last question, Dwayne, before we let you go. I'm just wondering, Aboriginal people aren't, you know, represented very well in the science subjects. How do we get Aboriginal kids really passionate about science so they're entering these fields? So maybe in the future we have a whole heap of Aboriginal scientists who will be doing this research themselves?
Well, we're doing that at Narragili at UNSW right now, and we're having fantastic results. We've been graduating Indigenous students doing PhDs in engineering, microbiology, biochemistry, all kinds of different academic areas. There are students who are getting into mathematics, students who are getting into astrophysics. It's really taking off now. I remember last year we had 6 Indigenous medical doctors graduate in December alone. So it's a huge push now, particularly at Nuragili, to get Indigenous students involved in science. And we're starting that by hitting them in schools to get them quite young, get them interested, get them fascinated. We have winter schools and projects. We bring the students in. They go to labs. They go to observatories. They go do hands-on stuff. Then they come to UNSW or other universities, and they do science. And at UNSW right now, of the, I think it's 350 Indigenous students we have in the university, almost half of them are doing science, math, and engineering.
Oh, that's awesome. That's great.
So there's a whole load of students coming and doing that now.
All right. Well, Dwayne, we've got to wind up. Our time's run out. I could talk to you all day or listen to you and Amy talk. I mean, it's great.
Sorry, I dominated the conversation. Sorry about that, Tiger.
Don't apologise. You're good at your job. It's great. Dwayne, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it. And if Amy's on the ball, which she always is, I imagine we'll be talking to you again before too long.
Oh, fantastic. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for that.
Thank you, and thanks for the great work you're doing, man. Really good to hear. You have a good day.
Have a great day, guys.
Bye now. Dr. Dwayne Haymacher, an American from Missouri, working at University of New South Wales. He heads up the Indigenous Astronomy Project at University of New South Wales. Yeah?
Yep, that's right.
Been interesting field of work. You'd love that job, wouldn't you?
I wish I'd have become an astronomer.
Being his offsider, ain't
it? I wish I'd have done that. I'm too old now.
No, you're never too old. You're never too old. You could be a journalist in that field, writing and then in that
do
field.
Do both.
You can do that. You do it all. It's time for The River Story. Written and recorded by Ross Watson. This is his what he wrote for his PhD. And we play a segment each morning towards the end of Let's Talk. Hope you enjoy it.
On the third day of their march, the grass people were awoken by the noisy arrival of some people from permanent camps in their own country. These distressed individuals had hurried throughout the night to tell of terrible happenings at home camps the previous day. Large groups of full people had surprised them, and the killing had been swift and bloody. Survivors were forced out at spear point, and only a few of those field workers who declared willingness to accept ancient law were allowed to remain. The rest were being sent northeast, unarmed and under escort. The few healthier ones were sent to the invasion group with the news of how total the attack had been. Gungaloo veterans said the camp erupted in pandemonium when huge columns of smoke were seen to fill the western sky, confirming the news of devastation. As full daylight spread through the camp, so too did the pervasive smell of distant smoke wafted on the fitful early morning breeze and mingled with the smell of their campfires. Then a strange sound filled the air and stilled all voice and movement. The sound was as a dozen clapsticks magnified 1,000 times. Stunned, the grass people looked about, and many observed piles of deadwood stacked in a semicircle close around their huge camp during the night. As the sun cleared the eastern slope, a great moan came from the grass people. On the ridge crests, they saw warriors massed in unbroken lines, extending around on three sides, rattling weapons and shields for battle. And the grass people knew they were disadvantaged. Uncertainty rose in the hearts of the would-be invaders. Never before had such huge numbers of free people warriors been seen or imagined. The previous fighting experience of the grass people was against isolated clans who were usually always outnumbered and unprepared. The full people had never been known to congregate in big groups to fight. Their disputes were usually small affairs involving a handful of participants and were settled quickly according to kin and totem safeguards. and the grass people saw and were fearful. As the first lines advanced down the slopes, wave after wave of painted warriors appeared at the crests, all shoulder to shoulder, and followed down toward the grass people. All the fighting men were heavily armed with spears, fighting sticks, and the dreaded killer boomerangs, capable of splitting a sturdy shield with a direct hit. Each man in the front mass of lines carried woomerangs and more than a handful of spears. These were the first lines the grass people saw. They knew woomerangs were designed to launch missiles a long distance, and many invaders were visibly terrified. But the chiefs were outstanding and fearless warriors and ordered their people to stand firm, even as they realized the free warriors heavily outnumbered them. A greybeard stepped forward when the advancing lines paused well within long spear shot of the grass people. He walked empty-handed to the deadwood piles and addressed the invaders. Grass eaters, listen well. Your new knowledge is against the law of the sacred serpent and has caused you to invade your neighbor's country. You kill trees and make water muddy. Relations between your men and the women are against all kinship law. You have become bullies and forsaken the ancient law. We now banish you from this land. Look west and see the smoke from the remains of your camps and grasses. Then look at the ridges and know you are in our hand. Your day of reckoning is today. You die here or walk north. If you walk, travel only through the long grass during daylight, or you will walk no farther. Camp only where we light a fire in front of you or die. We have no more words for you forever. The speaker raised an arm and made a cutting motion diagonally across his body. While the greybeard had been speaking, concealed warriors twirled sticks and breathed on smouldering wood dust. The dozens of wood piles were soon alight. The flames spread in the long grass, and soon the camp was surrounded on three sides by advancing walls of smoke and fire. Panic sent almost half of the would-be invaders in retreat to the north. Many south of the waterhole fled, scrambling and splashing through rather than going around. The chiefs rallied their bullymen to face the flames and ordered the evacuation of the camp.
Wow. There's a conflict.
Definitely.
There's a conflict. That's the river story. And that's that particular segment was about the conflict between the First Nations mob and the grass people who'd stepped away from natural law and started to do the wrong thing by Mother Nature and by human beings. Interesting, Amy, interesting.
Yeah.
Don't miss tomorrow. See how they go.
It's getting more exciting.
It is. Our guest tomorrow.
Jeff McMullen? Yeah, to talk about his Vincent Lingiari speech.
Yeah, Vincent Lingiari speech. Only Friday night, Saturday night?
Yeah,
last week.
Friday night, I think.
Very good. Haven't heard from Jeff for a while. Be good to have him on the program. You make sure you join us for Let's Talk on your local First Nation station. Well, have a great day.